This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 40. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or are just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's going on this week, Rob?
You know, it's been a pretty slow week for me. I was up in Seattle, well, Redmond and Bellevue last week for the Microsoft MVP Summit. That was a lot of fun. It was good to catch up with some old friends, and it's my fourth summit. So I know a few folks and interface with the team and such, hear about new ASP.NET stuff and some Windows Phone stuff. I went and attended a couple of the Windows Phone sessions. So to kind of hear some stuff that's coming down the pike. It was good. It rained a bit. It snowed, actually, on Saturday, which was kind of cool. Reminded me, you know, I live in California now, and it used to snow in Boston when I lived there, so I haven't had snow in a while.
Very cool.
It was good. I was really surprised. There was a room of maybe 300 MVPs, and the Windows Phone, he's like the product manager, or program manager, they're called, and he asked how many MVPs had Windows Phones, and it was insane. It was like 85% of the people in the room.
Really?
It was crazy.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. And just seeing people around the conference or the summit, everyone would be on that. It's like the Samsung, there's a certain model of it, you know, and it's kind of the default one, the Samsung Windows Phone. And sure enough, man, it's a neat OS. Like I have an iPhone. I love it. But I really, if this had come out when the iPhone did, I would have considered this. It's legit. They've done a really good job on it. So I know I can't speak for, you know, obviously they're a couple years behind and they don't have the market share. But if this really is a 10-year race like people are talking about, I could see Microsoft being the third player with Android and iPhone.
Interesting. Yeah, I've heard a lot of good things about the Windows Phone and, you know, the operating system and the development environment, but I've never actually worked with it myself, and I've never seen it up close and personal. So I'm interested to see how all that stuff works and how it would be put together, but it'd be nice to have the time to just sit down and play around with it, but I just don't have the time.
Yeah. No, I was really impressed with the scrolling. It feels good. You know how the iPhone it really feels good, right? That's the big thing. It's such a lame thing. If you don't own an iPhone, that sounds like the lamest statement ever, but it does. It feels intuitive, and the Windows Phone does as well. And the fonts are really nice. The design is gorgeous. I mean, it's a well put together operating system. Yeah, you don't traditionally think of Microsoft being able to pull that off, but they really did on this one. The other thing that's fantastic about it is the development environment, from what I've heard, is by far the best for any mobile device. It just kicks the crap out of Android and BlackBerry and iOS.
Right. Well, it uses Visual Studio, doesn't it?
It does. And it's Silverlight, essentially. Mm-hmm. You can use XNA to build games, which is the language. But if you want to just build apps, it's Silverlight, and it's the tools. You know, I mean, Visual Studio is just really, really good, very powerful. So it's much better than trying to, Objective-C with Cocoa and all that stuff. I mean, I'm not going to mock that or anything, right? We don't want to start a religious war here, but I've just heard there's a lot of challenges with that. It's a very complex thing to learn, so.
Yeah, well, I've also seen some interesting arguments about how it's obvious from the success of the iPhone and the App Store from Apple that it's not necessarily how well the development environment is put together for the developers. It's about the customer experience and the ability to sell through to that market. And that's what will really drive sales and the business behind that. You know, we'll see. I mean, maybe having a great development environment will help that along. But, you know, it's obviously early, so it's hard to say.
Yeah, they're certainly behind in the game, right? I think Apple has 130 million iOS devices. That's iPod touches, iPhones, all generations, and iPad, somewhere in there. Microsoft, I think Windows Phone 7 has like 1 million to 2 million. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very small. It's only been on sale a few months, but still, you know, they have a lot of catching up to do. So again, if it's a 2-year race or 1-year race, they're hosed. But if it is truly a 10-year thing that some pundits are saying, I think there's room for three players. So again, but in June, my iPhone contract is up. I'm probably going to get another iPhone. I'm probably going to go with another. So at this point, I'm not going to switch, but it does bring me joy to know that there are other options. I mean, I think Android is a perfectly viable option from times I've used a friend of mine's phone. And it'd be really nice to have three solid players in the market, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That are not BlackBerry.
Exactly. There we go. Yeah.
That's what it comes down to.
That's right. So how about you? Have you had anyone, I don't know, maybe cut your cornea with a scalpel lately?
You would bring that up right away. This past Saturday, I had LASIK surgery done. So I went in around 11:45 and walked out the door at, it was like 3:30, 4 o'clock, and it had LASIK surgery done. And today I have pretty good vision, to be perfectly honest. My eyes are a little bit dry here and there, but I've been keeping them hydrated with all the different drops that they gave me and the, you know, the eye steroids and the eye anti-inflammatories and stuff. And, you know, it's gone pretty well. I mean, I can see pretty far away without glasses, and I can drive without them. And I'm sure I'll have to go to the, you know, Department of Motor Vehicles at some point and say, hey, I can actually read this stuff. But it's only been 2 days since that happened. I mean, even the next day, I could see far enough and drive and see clearly. So it's been a really good experience so far.
Awesome. Yeah, for listeners out there, I had the old LASIK about 7 years ago. It was just a little, I mean, it was still a really good laser treatment, but Mike has like a new generation of it. But so now we both had it, and we compared war stories that we won't bore you with on the podcast, but it's good to hear, man. It's great to not have glasses anymore.
Yeah, I was actually thinking that I might be able to cancel this podcast and push it off because of the eye surgery. The listeners probably won't know this, but I had pushed off the previous podcast because I came down with pneumonia, and then the podcast before that I had to push off because of the snow on my roof. So I was thinking I might be able to push off a third one, but I can see. Right. So I guess I could.
Yeah.
Excuse.
Typically, we're several weeks out with our podcast, and now we're like, we have to publish one in about 4 hours from now. So we're, no, I'm just kidding. But we don't have nearly as much lead time as usual because we've canceled a few. So how about what else?
Well, I haven't really done too much on Audit Shark, and you know, that's kind of a bummer, but it's mainly because the pneumonia that I had grounded me for about 2 full weeks. So I've been trying to play a little bit of catch up since then, and then plus with the eye surgery, you know, that sets me back a little bit. But I was able to spend some time doing some performance improvements, and I've got a unit test that actually goes through, and I use it more for performance testing than actual unit testing for this particular scenario. But I do 1,000 iterations through this particular loop, and it simulates auditing 1,000 machines at a time. So it's basically simulating doing 10 million loops through this code. And I was able to do some performance profiling on it, and it improved the performance of that by about 20%. So it was a pretty significant improvement by just taking a look at the code and just rearranging things a little bit, just changing where some of the declarations were made, reusing some of the variables as opposed to recreating them every time I needed to do something, so the garbage collector didn't have to kick in every 10 milliseconds or whatever. But yeah, it did pretty well, and you know, I'm pretty happy with that 20% performance improvement, because this is a core component of the code that's going to be used a lot. I mean, as I said, this one spot, it was hitting this one set of code 10 million times. And, you know, it's just, I got 20% performance improvement out of it.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, work. Yep. Cool. And then I think the only other thing is I met with one of the members of the Micropreneur Academy earlier this month here in D.C. And his name's Avery Smith. He's got a product called Job Gizmo, which we sat down and we actually talked about it for probably about 2 or 3 hours or so, just kind of walking through some of the different issues he was having with both development and pricing and everything. But it's pretty interesting. It's a way to organize your job searches so that you can keep track of what jobs you've applied to and which ones you haven't. And it's a lot more helpful than something like if you use monster.com or dice.com, you can use their built-in stuff to kind of help you organize your resume and things like that, but it doesn't really help you organize and figure out which jobs you have and haven't applied for, especially when you go to a different job listing site. And his software, you know, helps solve that problem. So it's called Job Gizmo. It's at jobgizmo.com. But it was pretty interesting discussion. I mean, we talked about pricing, we talked about marketing, all kinds of different things. But it was really fun to, you know, just sit down and talk to another entrepreneur about, you know, what he's doing and how he's going about it and what sort of challenges he's facing.
That's cool. Is that in beta right now or is it live?
He's still working out some of the kinks. I think he's got it in beta right now and he's been testing it with a few different people. I don't know what his go live date is on it.
By the time this podcast
goes out, it may be out there. I don't know exactly.
Cool.
So today we're going to answer a bunch of questions that have come in. We do this every once in a while because some of these questions kind of queue up a little bit. What we're going to do is just go through some questions that some listeners have sent in to us, either on, you know, over the email or through the podcast line. And the first one, this one seems like more of an opinion question than anything else. The question is, what is the best development language for logic and updating databases, and what web page creator or editors do you recommend? So what's your take on this?
So I think the answer really is it depends, right? It depends on what you're building. If you're building a basic web application, the first thing I would say is, do you know a language, right? Do you know .NET or PHP or Cold Fusion or something? Because then I would lean towards that, because making minor changes here and there, even if you were to, say, outsource development, if you don't know it well enough to build it yourself and you're going to outsource development, you're going to want to make tweaks down the line. So I'd say to lean towards that if you already know a web language. The other factor comes into play is, if you are going to outsource, PHP developers tend to be less expensive, and they tend to be easier to find than Ruby and .NET. Yes, I know there's Java and Cold Fusion and other web languages and Python and those types of things, but the developers are, they do tend to be harder to find, and they tend to be more expensive. So I'm really going to talk about the big three of Ruby.NET and PHP.
Do you really think that .NET developers are easy to find? And well, I think they're probably easier to find, but do you think that they are cheaper to hire?
No, I think PHP are the cheapest and easiest to find. And then I would say Ruby is probably next, and .NET would probably be similar to Ruby, or maybe a little bit higher in terms of cost and harder to find. And then it goes, I think Cold Fusion would be above that, and I think Java would be above that. Now, I haven't tried to outsource, you know, Java JSP website development, just because I don't build sites in that. I have done Cold Fusion, and it was definitely harder than when I've looked for .NET and PHP guys. So I don't actually know Ruby. I've only heard from anecdotally from a friend of mine who tried to do it. But all that said, so I would lean towards PHP if you have no other bent and you're not going to change the code or anything. In addition, if you wind up selling this at some point, PHP tends to be a decent language, you know, on the open market in terms of a lot of people know it. So it's just an easy interchange if you're going to sell it to someone. They do tend to shy away from .NET if you're like selling on Flippa or something, because .NET has development costs in terms of you need certain tools to work on it, and it tends to be more enterprise driven. With all of that said, if you're not just building some consumer website that, you know, inserts widgets in and out of a database, and you are building something that's more corporate or more enterprise driven, and you're going to maybe interact with printer drivers or interact with imaging or, you know, anything like that, then I would definitely lean towards .NET, because it just is so, you know, enterprise geared, and it has tons and tons of plugins and components. The ecosystem is fantastic. Now, they'll cost you, you know, have to buy, but you can do things with .NET, like barcode reading and just all kinds of imaging stuff that is virtually impossible or really, really hard to do with, you know, the other web languages, so to speak.
Well, I think part of that is because .NET kind of crosses the line from being not just a web language, but into, you know, something that's a compiled executable that sits on the machine and can run as a desktop application, whereas,
absolutely,
you know, yep, those other languages are not really geared for that sort of thing.
Yep, not as geared. Now, Java does a bit, but again, take our words with a grain of salt. Mike and I have both been .NET developers for years. Now, I did do Java development for about 2 years, but it was all web. I didn't ever build a desktop app. And
I did. You know, it sucked.
Yeah. And I mean, that's how I felt about it as well. But that, you know, but I have also coded PHP and Cold Fusion, and then, but .NET was probably a 7-year thing for me. So this is our perspective. We're not saying we're absolutely right. You know, we're not. This is just, these are our opinions.
Yeah, I mean, as I started out and said, I mean, this is more of a personal preference question than anything else. It's really what you're more comfortable with. There's no best programming language, and anyone who says otherwise is,
yeah,
is trying to sell something probably. But
what's your,
you know,
take though?
My take?
I've kind of answered, and I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I prefer working with .NET. My AuditShark product is built in .NET, and my .NET forum software is built with .NET. That's the environment that I prefer working in. That said, I've done PHP. I've never actually worked with Ruby, but I've taken a look at it before. I've worked with MySQL. I've worked with Java. And I just prefer the tool environment behind .NET. That said, when it comes time to implement like a web application and I'm going to outsource it, I will specifically look for people who are going to do it in, you know, PHP using the LAMP stack or do something along the lines of Ruby. And the reason is because it is cheaper and I can follow the code. And if I'm outsourcing it, the reason I'm outsourcing it is because I don't want to write the code. So it's okay if it's written in another language because I'm not the one who has to deal with working with those tools.
Yep. No, that makes sense. And I think, you know, the fact that you're writing AuditShark in .NET makes perfect sense because you have to go out and kind of do some hardware integration. You have to talk to Windows desktops and servers, right?
Right, right.
And like, imagine trying to do that with PHP. Mm-hmm. You know, it would be a fiasco. .NET is just happens to be set up to do that because, you know, they're going to be running Windows OSs and stuff. So
right.
In your case, that's the perfect solution for your case. So.
Yeah, and there's all these components that are available that make it possible for me to also integrate it into the Linux and Unix environment as well, which it just makes it phenomenally awesome to be able to do that and essentially make AuditShark into a cross-platform solution.
Right. I'd love for both of us to kind of toss out the negatives, like why not? Why not to use .NET?
Why not?
Yeah. Why would someone use? Yeah. Why would someone not use it?
It can get complicated. I mean,
yeah, pretty quickly.
.NET's in the version 4.0 right now, and if you don't necessarily stay on top of things like Link to SQL and the Entity Framework and some of the different newer libraries that have started to be incorporated into .NET, or if you're not familiar with how Mono will be able to parse .NET code, if you're going to put something out there on a Linux machine or a Unix machine, there are all these things that kind of come into play that, if you don't truly understand how it works, you're probably going to have a hard time with it. And yep. It just makes it introduces a lot of complexity and has the potential to make it so that you just can't work with something at all.
Yeah, I would second that. I mean, I think it's easy to hurt yourself with .NET. You can hang yourself in any language, but especially, you know, .NET and Java are just, they're enterprise languages and they're really complicated. So I think if you don't know anything, like PHP is easier to get started with and kind of ramp up pretty quickly. If you don't know anything about .NET, there's a lot to it. So that's one negative. I think trying to, like we said, outsourced developers are more expensive and, you know, potentially harder to find. And then there's licensing costs, right? I mean,
yeah.
You have to have Windows OS, you have to have SQL Server. If they're on a shared host, that there's not that expensive. But
SQL Server, you can really get around with SQL 2008 R2 because it allows you to have up to 10 gigabyte databases.
For free?
For free.
Yeah, the Express. No, you're right. That's right. SQL Server is now pretty full-featured. And truthfully, if you really are a startup building a product, you get the BizSpark.
BizSpark,
it's like
yep.
3 years, it's free. I mean,
it's $100. It's
very, very
all access to everything. Yeah.
Right. But there is a cost to it, and Visual Studio, you know, is
not cheap.
You know, it depends. Yeah, it depends what you get. It's several hundred bucks a year, but I think you get that with BizSpark as well, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So then after the 3 years, you might have to pay some money. But anyways, that's probably the negatives, whereas PHP is free, MySQL is free. Because it's open source. I think the last thing is that the PHP ecosystem of open source is just a lot more, right? There's WordPress and about a zillion other apps for pretty much anything you want to do already built in PHP. And
yeah.
In .NET, there are some open source apps, but the ecosystem is not nearly as large.
Yeah, the other thing is for the expectation and the Microsoft side of things is that if you want a plugin for .NET, chances are you're going to have to pay for it. If you want a plugin for anything that's PHP related, chances are it's open source and it's free.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Number two is, I'd like to know your experience with virtual assistant services. How can I have a single toll-free number and have it randomly forward to any of my virtual operators standing by working on their own phones? What are your thoughts on this? My first thought was, why would you need to have somebody answering the phones? You know, what is it you're doing that you really need to have somebody answering the phones? But what's your take on this?
Right. So that's my first thought too, is, you know, do you need someone to answer the phones? But let's just say that there is a compelling reason. I think, there's a couple options here. Google Voice allows you to reroute a number. He says randomly. And that, I'm kind of like, do you really mean randomly? Or do you mean like depending on the time of day? Or because with Google Voice or with Call 8, which is K-A-L-L and then a number 8.com, they allow you to set a time of day to where it forwards to your cell number or it forwards to, you know, a different number based on the time of day. So if that's all you need, then it's easy. Google Voice, you don't get an 800 number. You just get a local exchange. And I think it's U.S. and Canada only. And then Call 8, I think, is U.S. and Canada only as well. And that, but you can get an 800 number for $2 a month or $3 a month. That's a pretty good service, a good way to go. I use it for a few products. But if you're looking for something more than that and looking to go with more of a phone system that actually, you know, you can have a voicemail recording and do some stuff with that, but you can't do complex phone trees. The one that I've heard about over and over but have never used is Grasshopper. They advertise on a bunch of podcasts and stuff, but it's, I don't even know the URL, but search for it on Google. It's the Grasshopper phone system, and you can do somewhat complex phone trees. I'm not 100% sure if you can say there are four extensions and randomly choose the next one, you know, or round robin it or something.
To yeah, try I think to you
distribute
do.
The load.
Yeah, you definitely do more of a round robin sort of thing. Yeah, I mean, there's no good reason for doing it randomly.
Right. Yeah, to round robin it. So I don't know if you can do that. I would think you could, but I don't know. So. That's my answer. I don't do a ton with phones beyond having the numbers, and I do sales and stuff through them, but I don't have a bank of VAs answering stuff. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely services out there that allow you to have more of an internet based phone system, but they do cost money. I mean, it's hard to find free or low cost options for those sorts of things.
Yeah, you can go with virtual PBXs and stuff and just search and find something that does it, but it's like you said, it's probably going to be pretty pricey. I think the question might be implying, you know, they want it fairly inexpensive.
Yeah. There's this option that you can get for phone systems called call hunting. And essentially what you do is you set it up so that when a particular phone number is called, the phone system will hunt for a open phone line. So if you get five phone numbers from the phone company, you can publish only one of those numbers and set up call hunting such that the phone company will attempt to route a call to that first number. And if it's busy, it will route it to the second number. And if that's busy, it will route it to the third number. And it will keep trying all the different phone numbers until it finds one that's available. And that's something that you could also get probably set up through a virtual PBX system. So hopefully that answers some of the questions that you might have around that. Again, I think initially I would probably question why you might set something up like that, especially if it's a smaller endeavor. I mean, how much phone support are you realistically expecting to receive? But it's, you know, it's a valid set of options if it really is required for your business.
So question number three comes from Dwayne, who has a website called ShakespeareGeek.com. And Dwayne says, this is paraphrased, it was a couple paragraphs. It says, how do you monetize an idea? I run a community. I hesitate to call it a blog, though technically that's what it is. It's at ShakespeareGeek.com, and I've been doing that for 5 years. So I've got reasonable traffic, a dedicated following. I'm organically number one for a bunch of keywords on Google. All that's been doing just fine. It's worth noting for context that I'm not talking about actors and theater people, nor am I talking about academics. I'm talking about a community for regular people who happen to like learning about Shakespeare. So it's a hobby group is what I'm gathering. And there's a couple questions. Can you maybe spend some time on how to monetize an idea rather than a product? I know you did a show on the different monetization models themselves, such as consulting, pay-per-use, micropayments, subscriptions, etc. But that's not what I mean. I mean, how do you start out with an idea like services for engaged couples and end up with a toolkit for creating your own website? Okay, so I think this is an interesting question. And I think the first thing I'll say is, it's, you know, I know Dwayne calls it a community, but he's right. You know, it looks like a blog, so let's kind of call it a blog for the sake of how we're discussing it. I think this is actually one of the issues I have with a lot of the books and podcasts that I listen to about kind of making money online, not in the shady way, but like Gary Vaynerchuk is one example. He says, you know, passion, community, and then, you know, you'll figure out how to make money. And there's a couple podcasts I listen to, Internet Business Mastery, although I don't listen to them anymore. They've kind of gotten a little off track. But back in the day, they used to say the same thing. Start a podcast or a blog, gather a following, and, you know, and then you can make money. There's a really good one actually called Foolish Adventure that I do recommend. They have a lot of good marketing tips and stuff. But that's the approach they all list. And I have a real issue with it because I don't believe that it necessarily happens in most niches. I think if you have some very large niches and it's people who are either going to save money or make money based on what you have to offer, then they're going to be willing to pay something. But if you have a smaller niche or you have something that's a hobby like learning about Shakespeare, it's just a whole different ballgame, right? Because you can't offer, you know, some info product for $97 and expect someone who wants to learn about Shakespeare to buy it. right? It's going to be, they're just going to be smaller numbers and lower price points and all that kind of stuff. So I guess that's the first thing I'll say, is it is actually pretty dang hard to monetize a blog and make any reasonable money from it. Contrary to what you read on ProBlogger and, you know, hear about if you listen to any of the podcasts I've mentioned. You have any thoughts, time being?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you. It's you will certainly see examples of people out there who are making $8, $10, $15, $20,000 a month from doing a blog. But you also have to keep in mind that those are exceptions, not necessarily the rule. I mean, you can get a lot of traffic, but just having a lot of traffic does not equate to making money from it. And especially when you start talking about a niche market like people who are interested in Shakespeare. I mean, things that come to mind for something like that is, I think you had said, you know, it's not as if you could sell an info product. I think you can, but I think you would end up selling something more like Cliff's Notes for, you know, certain Shakespeare plays or something like that. And the price point, as you pointed out, is not going to be $97. It's probably going to be like $9 or $7, yep, because you're not going to be able to make a whole lot of money. And you're going to have to spend a significant amount of time doing analysis and research on a particular play in order to churn out something that people are going to pay $9, $10, $15 for. And it's going to be a fairly significant investment, and you're probably not going to make a huge amount of money from it. But I think you're absolutely right. I don't know as you can just create a blog and start making money from it. I think it's a lot harder than most people will make it out to be.
Right. And even with the number one Google rankings organically, that's fantastic. But it really does depend on how many people that actually brings in. Because if you're ranking for really low volume terms, then, you know, if you're getting 1,000 uniques a month or 2,000 uniques a month, I really wouldn't try to monetize the blog at this point. I think once you're up over 5,000, and this depends on your niche. If you happen to be in a, you know, internet marketing or SEO or something that really, you know, make money online, some niche that really has motivated people, then you don't need nearly as much traffic. But if you're in a hobby niche, like something like Shakespeare, I really think you need to get above 5,000 to 10,000 uniques a month, preferably up over 20, frankly. And then there's a number of ways. Honestly, I think you should start with the bottom of the barrel and just try AdSense and see what happens. And my guess is you're not going to make very much money, because the clicks for those terms are not going to be high paying clicks. You're going to get 5 cent clicks all over the place, because the niche is just not one that has a lot of cash flow in it, basically. And that's going to be the problem, is then trying, you can then go to try to find niche advertisers. But who are you going to find? I mean, you're going to find theater companies. You're going to find people selling Shakespeare DVDs. None of these things are necessarily large volume, you know, and high price things. So, but those are other avenues I go down, looking for other advertisers. You can certainly talk about if there happen to be products available on Amazon, but you're only going to make 4% on those sales.
Yeah, I mean, he's already, if you look at his site, he's already done that. Like at the very, very bottom, there's a link to Amazon. But, you know, he's got a lot of different things on here that he's obviously trying. You know, it looks like there's something here from Zazzle for having T-shirts and mugs made. There's a tip jar. There's the Amazon ads. Looks like there may be, you know, some stuff here for Facebook and Twitter. I mean, he's doing a lot of the things that you would typically expect. And I think, you know, part of the question is coming from, I've tried all the things that everybody has said to try and I'm not getting results. Can you help? And right. I think you're absolutely right. There are certain places where you can try this type of thing and you may get a decent amount of traffic, but certain places you're just not going to be able to monetize them. And there's literally nothing you can do.
Yeah, the only other thing, so I'm glad you pointed me, I hadn't actually clicked through the site today.
Slacker.
yeah, well, I'd seen it when the question came in, but I didn't see it today. So there are some ads on it. I think the one other thing is to look at models like Zen Habits. If you go to zenhabits.com, he basically wrote an ebook about Zen habits, right? It's about like minimalism and being Zen and a bunch of other stuff. But I think he sells them really cheap, like $7 or $9. And so he sells some, you know, some of them. And I think that's a good way to go. I think if you write quality material and you have an audience that likes your stuff, then cranking out your own, you know, digital products, essentially. And whether that, if you're best on audio, then, and that's applicable, then record some audio. Either have someone interview you over Skype or interview them, and you can have a transcription done relatively inexpensively. And then you have essentially this PDF and a, you know, 1 hour audio thing, and bam, I mean, you can pretty easily sell that for, you know, $19 with audio. Again, depends on the niche. You can sell for a lot more if it's in a higher paying niche. or if you just want to write an ebook, 20, 34 page ebook, that you got to find out what your audience wants. That's the thing. I mean, I really think you need to put out a survey. Unless you already know something that they're going to be willing to pay for, you need to find out what they're going to be willing to pay for. So I think you need to talk to some folks and or put a survey on your blog in a post and try to get as many people to give their feedback on, you know, what they'd be interested to hear about. And then you can go further. You can take it and do video, or you could do screencasts if that's applicable. Again, I don't know how that would fit into a Shakespeare blog, because I don't exactly get the niche, but I think those are probably going to be some ways to explore. And I do think they'll all bring in more money than doing the Amazon ads and the AdSense and stuff like that. So I hope that helps. So, you know, the second part of his question is, how do you get past the mental hurdle where you keep telling yourself nobody will pay for that? Well, you need to ask people. Don't just build something randomly. You have to talk to your audience. Any comments on that, Mike?
Not really. I mean, I agree. You have to ask people.
Yeah. So before I wrote my book, Start Small, Stay Small, I surveyed my blog and I said, what do you guys want to hear about? And I took that feedback and I put it in the book. And I knew that some people would be interested in those things. And then I used those things as bullet points on the back cover. And when I talked about the book, because I knew that it was stuff that people wanted to hear about. Obviously fulfilled that need because I sold some books. So I really think that that's your next step. You don't just build something blind. That's like the worst thing you can do.
Yeah, you have to do at least the minimal market research to figure out, is this something people want, before you go out and spend all this time either, you know, writing code or, you know, writing the book, and only to find out that nobody actually wanted it.
All right, moving on to our last question, number 4. It's from Eowyn. He says, hi guys, I have a question for you as I'm struggling with this. Visitors to my site, Bite-Size Irish Gaelic, come from different sources. I pay for traffic, including custom display ads and AdWords. I try to squeeze their email from them as soon as possible. Some people buy after clicking through from email newsletters, others buy directly on the site. But how can I tell their original source? For example, if the person comes from AdWords or a banner display and then signs up for email and eventually pays for my service, is there a way for me to tell that they specifically came from AdWords? Thanks, Eowyn. Okay, so the problem Eowyn's talking about is this problem called the last click syndrome. And typically a tool like Google Analytics will attribute their purchase to the last click that they made. So often your sales cycle requires many visits to your site, and it may require 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 3 months, you know, depending on what product you're selling. And basically the last time they come, which is typically going to be maybe through a link in an email, or maybe they just type it in directly, then they buy, then that's going to get attributed with your purchase, not the thing that they came, you know, through 3 months ago when they clicked on the link in the search engine. So this is a very common problem. I think Mike and I each have an approach or a suggestion. The best way I've heard to deal with this is to use KISS Metrics. And this is made by Heaton Shaw. And it's a really cool tool that basically solves this problem. It tries to put cookies and track stuff for you. And it tracks your funnel, even if it's not the same visit. And of course, it costs money, but it's invaluable, right? You don't have to write custom code. You just create your funnel there, and then it spits out some JavaScript, and you paste that in a page or two, and it's done. And then you get these nice reports. So it's kissmetrics.com. We'll list it in the show notes. So that's the solution that I've heard about. Mike, how about you? I think you have another idea.
Yeah. I mean, as you said, the other way you can go about it is to, you know, write your own custom code that will analyze where the person originally came from. You drop some cookies on their machine. Obviously, the problem associated with that is making sure that the cookies get on the machine, and, you know, dealing with all the different, you know, idiosyncrasies of different browsers, or whether the person comes from a different machine or a different device from one time to the next, and trying to associate multiple devices or machines. You know, maybe it's the exact same user, and you would be able to tell that by, you know, if you send out an email in a newsletter and it goes to somebody's phone. Well, they click on a link there and you drop a cookie on their phone. Well, when they go home and they browse from their desktop and they click on the same link because they want to actually go buy it, you want to be able to associate that same cookie with, you know, the person, because you know, it's the same newsletter link. So at that point, it introduces a lot of additional complexity. And if you can outsource all of that complexity to somebody, a service like Kissmetrics, that's going to save you probably a lot of hassle and a lot of headaches. And at that point, it may very well be worth it. If there are things that Kissmetrics doesn't do for you that you for some reason feel are absolutely necessary and you need that information, you're going to have to roll your own code. And, you know, it's going to be time consuming, and depending on how much money you're making from it, it may or may not be worth it.
Yeah, I think Kissmetrics, I thought I heard Heaton say in an interview that it does, like, they do some pretty complex stuff with, they use cookies. They also look at IPs. Obviously, IP addresses are not unique, you know, on incoming traffic because of the way cable and the internet and all that stuff set up. People share IPs, but they do the best they can, essentially. So I think they have some pretty complex algorithms going on there that even if someone tries to come from a separate device, it tries to figure out that it's them. But honestly, you know, don't know that for 100%, probably worth some more research if you are going to go down that road. The other thing is, yeah, doing it custom, I wouldn't be opposed to that. Like, I think that's a reasonable approach, but I do think that trying to track them, you're basically going to put a cookie on their machine and you need to save that code that if they do sign up to the email, you in MailChimp, you would want to add, or whatever your email provider is, but you'd want to add an extra field. You'd want to put that little code, you know, their customer number in their record. And then whenever you send them an email, you would want to include that in the query string of the link that they would click through from the email to track them back, just to make sure that you've re-identified them. And I don't think that's a terrible solution. I think that you would get most people that way. You'd really only miss the case where someone switches computers and then types you in directly and doesn't come back via an email link. And I think it happens, but it's a lot more rare than the other cases. So this is a good question. It's pretty common, and one I've asked myself in the past. So I definitely think either option is a good one. Well, I think that just about wraps us up for today. We're out of time. I hope we've answered all your questions. Feel free to keep them coming. You can send them to us via our voicemail number, which is 888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider writing a review in iTunes. Just search for Startups. I think we have 25 reviews. I mean, we have quite a few reviews, but we want to get more. So please, if you are, you know, a listener, we really would appreciate it. It definitely helps our rankings in iTunes and kind of helps motivate us to keep doing the podcast. You could subscribe to this podcast, of course, in iTunes or via RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control. It's by Moot, and it's used under Creative Commons. A full transcript of this podcast is available at our website, startupsfortherestofus.com. We will see you next time.